from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Cash-strapped state and local governments are increasingly looking to privatization as a way to cut costs. But opponents, such as California Assemblyman Roger Dickinson, say state workers are more dedicated and get the job done better than outside contractors. Dickinson has introduced a bill to that effect. It's called a Public Employees Bill of Rights. We'll debate the costs and benefits of privatizing public services. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Last month, Sacramento Democratic Assemblyman Roger Dickinson introduced Assembly Bill 1655, a public employee bill of rights designed to provide various protections to state civil service employees. We want to discuss the bill in this Forum hour, and we also want to probe the deeper related divisive question about the importance of protecting civil service employees and the ongoing controversy in these lean times over privatization of state and local services. Joining us, Roger Dickinson, California Assemblyman from the 9th District, and glad to have you here, Assemblyman. Good morning.
I'm happy to join you. Thank you very much.
Well, let's begin by talking about this in broad terms. It's supposed to provide the same rights and protections as peace officers and firefighters and, state managers and supervisors. But tell us specifically what's in this bill.
Well, essentially what we're doing, Michael, is taking a number of things that are either current practice or reflected in collective bargaining agreements and codifying them so it's clear what the rules are for both management and employees, and then plugging a few gaps that exist in current practice or have arisen in the last few years. For example, we're looking at measures that would ensure that if there are state employees available who have the expertise to do the work, that they would be used before we would go out to the marketplace. That's going to be more effective and less expensive for the taxpayer. We're making sure that state employees are protected if the state is sued and the employee is named individually in a lawsuit, that employee also has representation if that lawsuit involves allegations about things that have happened in the course and scope of employment. It's really fairly simple. I would describe it as fairly basic elements.
It's preference essentially for rank and file service civil service workers over management and outside contractors. I mean, it really is designed in some ways to ensure their employment. Yes.
Well, I wouldn't describe it that way, actually. What I would say is that if we have state employees in our workforce who have the ability to do the work and they are available to do the work, in other words, the capacity exists to do the work with existing state employees and the expertise, then we ought to use state employees first. That only makes sense from a cost-effectiveness standpoint. Why would we go out and hire somebody privately and pay them to do state work if we have state employees on the payroll, able to do the work and available to do the work?
Well, you've got contracts now outside of about 8% of state expenses. Isn't this possibly going to tie government hands if they want to get work outside?
No, I don't think so, Michael. If you look at the conditions under which the state currently can contract out, there are a number of different bases upon which that can happen. And in fact, in a hearing just a week before last, the Department of General Services told us that very few contracts actually are entered into by state departments on the basis that the private sector will be cheaper in doing the work than state employees. Most contracts that go out to the private sector for state work involve either specialized expertise, emergency situations, or temporary circumstances. So those those elements really wouldn't be affected at all, in my judgment, by this legislation.
Talking with Assemblyman Roger Dickinson from the 9th District, Democratic Assemblyman, who is putting forth an employee bill of rights, there's been some criticism, Assemblyman, that this would be essentially more difficult under your legislation. It's statutory, we ought to add, to essentially discipline or, well, do something about the incompetent or the dishonest workers. Say crime or embezzlement would have to be essentially discovered, investigated, and acted upon within a year under your bill.
The way we had error in drafting, and so this is something we will be amending. But here's the basic point. We want to make sure that investigations of inappropriate or illegal conduct by a state employee get consummated, get finished within a reasonable period of time from everybody's point of view. Right now, from the time of discovery of potential illegal conduct by a state employee, investigations of that conduct can drag on literally for years. And I have heard from my constituents who are state employees of numerous instances of this happening. So what it means is the employee truly is left a twist in the wind while the management simply takes its time for whatever motive or reason to get the investigation done. What we want to do is have that investigation concluded in an expeditious and reasonable period of time. So the bill we will amend to provide that from the date of discovery, the investigation needs to be concluded within 1 year thereafter. We really think that's similar to the idea of speedy trial that is a integral part of our criminal justice system, and that it's fair both to management and the public, by the way, as well as the employee.
And you say what to the criticism that this is excessive workplace rights and privileges for public employees? The public employees really don't need more protection, especially since a lot of this is common practice.
Well, I'd say two things. I'd say, first of all, this bill, once again, takes a number of things that are simply already practiced or in collective bargaining agreements and codifies them to ensure that they go on over time into the future and aren't subject to variation depending on the particular times. And secondly, I would say when one really looks at the bill and understands what it incorporates, these aren't very radical ideas. They are basic protections that any employee ought to have in a workplace.
Again, Roger Dickinson, California Assemblyman of the 9th District, and also sponsoring Assembly Bill 1655, a Public Employee Bill of Rights. Thank you, Assemblyman, for joining us.
Thanks for taking the time.
And that was a conversation I had earlier this morning with Roger Dickinson, California Assemblyman. We're going to continue this discussion, and we want to welcome John Ortiz, who's a reporter with the Sacramento Bee. He writes the paper's blog on state workers. Welcome, John Ortiz. Good to have you with us. Also want to welcome Donald Cohen, who is chair of In the Public Interest. They're a nonprofit resource center, and he joins us this morning from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Donald Cohen.
Thank you.
And we'll say good morning to Adrian Moore, Vice President of Policy with the Reason Foundation, a free market think tank that's based in Los Angeles. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Let me go, John Ortiz, to you. First off, I suppose the most immediate question for you, being a surveyor of this scene, is how likely is this bill that we heard about to go through?
I would expect that some parts of it will go through and some of the more controversial parts of it might be lopped off. But we've got Democrats controlling the legislature. We have a Democratic governor. This is a Democratic bill. And so I would imagine a good portion of this could make it to Governor Brown's desk.
What about the blowback, though? And not only from Republicans, but in fact, we'll probably hear from some listeners on this, the concern that there's been too much coziness in the past with the unions and the Democrats, and that this just heightens or exacerbates that in the public's mind?
Oh, I think that's definitely true. And it could put the governor in a little bit of a dilemma if he's looking to promote tax increases. He wants to get an initiative before voters in November. And if he's entertaining this bill while at the same time hoping to promote that measure, it could put him in a little bit of a PR pickle.
Well, he's been in certainly a pickle to some degree with the unions, who he has been seen as, from the beginning of his campaign, as a major supporter. And he has, like you say, this ballot measure that he has to try to see through or shepherd through. I'm also wondering what your take is just on the general, well, reaction up there in Sacramento in the legislature to fear of privatization from Democrats.
Well, I think that here's the problem, is that government does not police itself well. So we could see this bill go through and essentially very little change in terms of what happens with privatization. There are something on the order of two dozen specific statutes right now that tie strings to how the government hires out everything from, cooks in prisons to working on levees. And so, just because you have a law doesn't mean the bureaucracy follows the law. And I think that there's generally a frustration, and I think with some real legitimacy, there's some frustration on the part of elected officials that they keep trying to tighten this up and the bureaucracy keeps ignoring them.
Well, I'm wondering just your general sense when you think about Stockton trying to water, that is privatized water, or mm-hmm. Felton and their water supply. There's been a lot of, or for that matter, Schwarzenegger, former Governor Schwarzenegger, trying to privatize prisons. There's been a lot of resistance and a lot of just things not going through.
That's true. And I do think that the unions are very keenly aware that the unions are a core constituency for them. But I do think that they're in, we'll probably get into this during the course of the hour, but, I think when you look at this, everybody's hat is gray. The public sector can sometimes act very selfishly. The private sector can become a mercenary and come to view government as kind of a bottomless well of money from which to draw. And then, the taxpayer has to sit back and kind of look at all of this and evaluate who's right. It's a very thorny question.
It is a thorny question and a vexing one. And maybe we'll hear now from Adrian Moore, who's Vice President of Policy with the Reason Foundation, free market think tank based in Los Angeles. Adrian Moore, in most people's minds, the final assessment about privatization isn't really in, and yet you're an advocate. Why?
Well, I'm an advocate of taking a look at it. I think one of the most common errors everyone makes when they talk or think about privatization is that it is this sort of big, grand vision, ideological thing, when in fact it's a lot more like a socket wrench. It's a tool. If you treat it as a tool and you use it, you use a socket wrench to turn a nut and not to hammer a nail, it works just fine. It's not something that always works, as some, crazy people assert. It's not something that always fails, as some other crazy people will assert.
So you're saying it's part of it should be part of a toolkit in terms of better government.
It's a method for managed service. You mentioned Stockton, which is a great example, actually, of misperception, since the ownership of the water was never going to be private. But, Richmond in the Bay Area privatized its water system almost 30 years ago, and it's nationally known as one of the greatest successes, and in fact the city government there has long been an advocate of that model, and there are dozens of other cities around the state that have done so as well. Stockton was actually the aberration in that it became so controversial over matters mostly unrelated to the actual delivery of water, but it works when it works and it doesn't work when it doesn't work, and to think that it's always going to fail or always going to work is the big mistake.
But the big advantage of privatization, I think, from your perspective, is it reduces the size of government and it can really be safe costs.
It can reduce the size of government. I mean, generally, that's not how it works. Very rarely do we see privatization where the government says, we've been providing water and we're just going to walk away and you all have to figure out how to do it yourselves. That's not how it works. We have a bunch of city employees who are running the water utility right now, and we're considering hiring a management company to take over running that water utility. They're going to hire all those people, so the staff doesn't actually change very much, and the cost structure is going to change, and the accountability system is going to change. So is government smaller when you do that? Well, I mean, if they're spending less money on the water utility, maybe, but if they just use those savings to then shift that over to the education system or to the welfare system, then it didn't necessarily make government smaller, but it did hopefully make the water system more efficient, more up to date. I'm more interested in what are the benefits you get from using privatization properly as a tool than the idea that somehow local governments or the state privatizing Presidio Parkway project or something like that is going to have a big impact on shrinking government. That isn't really how it works.
And I know you're intimating that it ought to be, excuse me, a case-by-case situation, but what of the argument, and it's a general argument, that there are a lot of hidden costs with privatization. You have more people applying for unemployment benefits. You have really also, so the argument goes, no market accountability and often, in effect, natural monopolies without competition.
Well, yeah, but you have a lot of hidden costs with government provision of services, too. And you have a lot of, unintended impacts of that as well. It's not at all obvious from either from the research or just from sort of common sense and policy analysis that either one is always going to be superior or inferior. You've got to look at the situation you're in and the opportunities you have. You know, the conversation a few minutes ago was about the public employee protections is that the bureaucracy doesn't do a good job of policing itself. Well, there you go. This is privatization brings, if nothing else, more transparency to everything. Everybody pays more attention when there's a contract with a private provider than when the same old state agency or city department is doing it that has done it for all of our lifetimes. Nobody pays attention to that. When there's a contract, there's a lot more attention paid and therefore more accountability.
Again, Adrian Moore, Vice President of Policy with the Reason Foundation, and Donald Cohen is Chair of In the Public Interest. Well, let's take these two arguments from your perspective, Donald Cohen, the idea that privatization saves more money and that it brings more attention and more transparency.
Yeah, let me take those in reverse order. First, I agree with some of the things that Adrian said, but on that point, I think it's absolutely, I would disagree completely in terms of transparency. And let me make two points, one of which is I really like John's statement that the government doesn't police itself very well. The issue with contracting out, with government contracting, is I think it's similar. The government doesn't police contracts very well. It was only a few years ago that we had it, that California, as I understand it, had online access to all government contracts. And so what you find when governments contract out is that, and this is sort of at a practical level, I think everybody would understand this. If you contract to, add an addition to your home and you're not watching carefully, you often either get taken or corners are cut that you weren't aware of. And the same dynamic is true when government contracts out. And what typically happens is government doesn't when something goes from public to private, they typically hardly ever, I can't think of any examples, where they staff up adequately for auditing and monitoring to police the contracts very well. So that's the first point. Say, in terms of transparency, public records, state open records laws don't apply often to government contracts. So there's far less transparency when you contract out. I mean, if something's run by the, operated and run by the public sector, by government, pretty much everything is, retrievable by public records request or freedom of information at the federal level, and that's simply not true when contracts happen. I mean, there are lots of sort of subtle, the issue of the contracting process is also important, and I don't know the contracting process at the state level in California, but in many cases around the country, the process is often quite non-transparent until it's really kind of a done deal. The most, one of the archetypal examples is what happened in Chicago when Mayor Daley privatized, did a 75-year lease sale of all of the city's parking meters for $1.1 billion. The deal was made public on a Friday afternoon, and the city council had to vote on that Tuesday. And it wasn't until after the fact when the Inspector General of Chicago analyzed the deal and found out that the city sold too cheap and that the public had an opportunity to peel away at the contract to realize that there were features of that contract that were quite counter to the public interest. So on the point of transparency, that's completely disagree. On the point of cost savings, I think Adrian and I could probably come up with dueling examples of where it didn't save money and it did save money. I actually think for the most part it's not, you don't do it for cost savings. you contract, and governments have contracted since, you know, since the beginning of time and will continue to do so. The question is whether we do it with adequate protections. And so you save money if you take away, you know, if the worker had health care and doesn't have health care anymore. That's one of the ways they save money, and there's examples.
And on pensions, presumably.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And on pensions, presumably.
And on
pensions. That's been one of the big arguments.
Yeah, well, you take it away. I mean, so there's, or you take it away. So that's one place to save money. There's other places to save money that don't help us, right? San Jose right now, California, IBM just came out with a report that said it could save money by reducing the number of police officers, by replacing them with computers that predicted crime hotspots.
Yeah, we did a whole program on that.
Is that right? Yeah. So, I mean, that theoretically that would save money, but it's insane.
Well, what about, you talk about archetypal examples with contracts, what about privatizing roads with non-competition clauses? As I understand it, we've had a couple instances where they couldn't build a mass transit line, for example, because it would compete with the road. Yeah.
Yeah, those are typical features. That's why I think the real issue of contracting out and privatization is about what we want to control and how we want to control that. There are features in these long-term asset deals, that's our infrastructure deals, roads, similar to the parking meters in Chicago. There are these standard non-compete clauses is how they're referred to that, you know, and it's logical from the private sector's perspective. They don't want to go into a 50-year deal and know that the public is going to compete with them in 50 years. Let's say it's a toll road. But from the public's perspective, that if we lock ourselves into a deal for 50 years or 75 years or even 99 years, that where we can't even see the future, that we can't build mass transit, that it is, that would compete with that, we can't build a different road system, that we can't change the way we organize cities, that closes off our ability to control our own future. And that's, I think, costs. We can debate about costs forever. I think those are the more fundamental issues there that we need to grapple with. And you can deal with that with protections.
Well, I'm going to open the phone lines and find out what you, our listeners, think. Big question here, to privatize or not to privatize, but also curious to get responses that you might have about what is being put forth in front of the California legislature. We talked earlier with California Assemblyman Roger Dickinson about his bill, which, among other things, would ensure that employees have priority as far as over contractors and filling positions, and would reduce an excessive amount of what would be essentially state outsourcing activity. You can join us, and we do welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And feel free to join the program. Again, a discussion about Assembly Bill 1655, but also about privatization. Toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is yours. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and we do welcome your emails, forum@kqed.org, or post any question or comment you have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page. We spoke earlier with Assemblyman Roger Dickinson, who is California Assemblyman of the 9th District. John Ortiz is with us, reporter for the Sacramento Bee, who writes the paper's blog on state workers. We also have Donald Cohen on the line, chair of In the Public Interest, which is a nonprofit resource center, and Adrian Moore, vice president of policy with the Reason Foundation, a free market think tank based in Los Angeles. Your involvement in the program is welcome, so feel free to join us. We'll hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Cash-strapped, state and local governments are increasingly looking to privatization as a way to cut costs. That's true throughout the nation. And opponents here in California, such as California Assemblyman Roger Dickinson, are saying that state workers are more dedicated, get the job done better than outside contractors, and he introduced a bill to that effect. We're debating the costs and benefits of privatization of public services in this hour. We spoke earlier with the Assemblyman, Roger Dickinson, and John Ortiz is with us from the Sacramento Bee. Also, Donald Cohen from In the Public Interest and Adrian Moore are with us from the Reason Foundation. That's where Adrian Moore is vice president of policy. And we're going to go to your calls and emails and get you involved in this discussion. Really, a question is to privatize or not to privatize, but a bigger question of whether or not state employees and state workers need greater protection. Wanted to bring Robert Smith into this, and Robert Smith is with NPR's Planet Money. He's a reporter. You might have heard the piece he did on This American Life, which was focused on Colorado Springs, Colorado, an experiment with, well, privatization, and as I mentioned, major privatization. Robert Smith, good to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be here, Michael.
I guess the place to begin with this, before we get to the Hotel Broadmoor and the story of Steve Bartlin, who played a major role in this, was when they decided to, well, cut off the streetlights and have people pay for their own streetlights.
Yeah, you have to understand, Colorado Springs is one of these places that hates taxes, and they have very low property taxes, very low sales tax, and they had these restrictions on their government about, you know, the government couldn't raise taxes unless there's a vote of the people, they couldn't move money around, and, you know, that worked really well during the good times. And then when the recession came, Colorado Springs ran out of money almost immediately, and they went to the voters and they said, listen, we could really use a little bit more in taxes. The voters said, no way. And so the city sort of took some unusual steps. I mean, the first thing they decided to do was to sort of make the citizens pay for things like streetlights. They turned off all the streetlights and said, if you want your streetlight on, you have to pay $125. And people did it. People happily did that.
Some people didn't, right? There were lights on and off all over Colorado Springs.
Yeah, I mean, and for some people, they decided they liked their street dark, or they didn't have the money, or they didn't know about it. It was interesting because when we talked to a lot of people who did this, there were certainly people grumbled a lot about about things that you take for granted, right, that the city does, that your lights are going to be on, your sidewalks fixed. But there was also a sense of, you know what, if I value it, I'm willing to pay for it. And that way my money doesn't go to this government I don't trust, this thing where I don't know where the money is. I give them money, they turn on the streetlights. There's something simple about it.
Well, it got a lot more complex after that because then you're talking about city parks, caring for them and sprinklers and all kinds of major things that people take perhaps for granted as far as services. But let's bring in Steve Bartlin, a guy who runs and owns Hotel Broadmoor, which is a kind of Shangri-La. He got the idea that maybe there ought to be a free market way to handle all services.
Well, that's it. I mean, Colorado Springs, after they cut their budget, you know, so the streetlights are out. There are people who are mowing the lawns in the parks. There are people who are paying to have trash cans in their parks. So the city's trying to make do, and it's just getting worse and worse. It's looking ugly, and there are weeds everywhere, and the lights are out, and things are going terribly wrong. And this guy who runs this gorgeous, gorgeous hotel up in the hill says, wait a minute. I run a hotel. I run a business. Perhaps if government ran a little bit more like a business, if you ran your government like your hotel, then things would work better. And, you know, we subcontract out if we want people to do things and we don't feel like we have the expertise and we don't pay, you know, huge amounts of benefits. We don't pay our workers very much. Perhaps government can try the same thing.
Well, government did try the same thing in Colorado Springs. And then you featured a fellow named Roland who had 10 raises in 5 years when he was working for the government, was laid off because of the costs that government had incurred, and then wound up being hired in the private way.
Yeah, and this is really interesting. This was our goal when we went to Colorado Springs, because we knew that eventually in this story they ended up trying privatization, and the parks was the first place they tried this. They said, listen, there's all these landscaping firms, right? Colorado Springs is a tourist town. There are lots, anyone can mow a lawn. Why do we employ people mowing lawns when we can have somebody else do it, a private company? So we wanted to find, like, one guy. We wanted to find, in fact, Ira Glass described him as a guy who might be the citizen of the future, someone who used to do the job for government and now does the same job for a private firm. And we found this guy, Roland Hawkins, and yeah, he had a sweet government job driving a mower around these parks, and then he's laid off, and then he's rehired by a private firm. Same exact job, driving the lawnmower and keeping the parks looking nice. Except now, he makes less money. He gets less benefits. And as he said, he has to work a lot harder.
Let me add, and people can hear the whole story by going to This American Life's webcast, and it's a fascinating story. But in retrospect, as you look back on this experiment as a reporter, when you think about the way two sides will fight about size of government and government being smaller, resulting in less taxes and less costs, where do you come down?
You know, I come down on, this is not going to be a satisfying answer, but I come down on seeing how complex this is. So on one hand, it seems very simple, right? You hire back the guy, he does the same job for less money. Okay. But when we looked at the city's books and had them run us through all these numbers, overall, the city wasn't saving any money. Yeah, this guy Roland Hawkins was making less money, but the private firms had to make a profit, right? The private firms ended up buying a lot of equipment that the city already had that was idle. So at the end of the day, it sort of ended up being this wash in terms of saving money. But the weird thing about it was there were a lot of people who were happy. They were happy to see private firms doing this. It just fit with the way they feel government should be. You know, if a private firm can do it, a private firm should do it. And Roland Hawkins, the guy who got privatized, as we say, he wasn't unhappy with it. He would have preferred making more money, but he wasn't unhappy. But he said something interesting, which actually didn't get into the story, which was he felt bad because in the old days when he did a good job in the parks, people would say, look, the city's doing a good job. And now he says when he's doing a good job in the parks, people say, oh, the private sector's doing a good job. This landscaping firm is doing a good job. And he felt that sort of the less that government does, the less people appreciate it. You know, it's not as if government gets credit when it privatizes things out. People feel like, oh, I guess we didn't need it in the first place. And in some ways, there's a cycle of distrust of government that gets fed into. The less government does, the more people say, good riddance, we don't need it.
Robert Smith, again, with NPR's Planet Money, you can go to This American Life and hear this story about Colorado Springs. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And we're going to have our listeners join us. Let's go to your calls. Rich, you're up first. Hi, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing?
Thank you. Okay.
Basically, I worked for the city of San Jose for 30 years. I retired in the real estate division, so I bought governmental acquisition and business relocations. I bought a lot of the land, most of the land for the Sharks Arena, for example, and relocated all the businesses. Currently, I'm a private acquisition relocation consultant, and I'm against actually the government farming things out, and I'm going to tell you why. We had a lot of problems with the consultants that we brought in, business relocation consultants or even computer programming consultants. They come in, they charge way more than what my staff was getting. They're in the hundreds to $200 an hour range. They're in and out. After they do the project, you can't ever get to them most of the time to have them correct their problems. That's one thing. The other thing I want to mention is the city of San Jose was considering at one point to farm out some of their engineering services. And here's a scenario, and I'm going to use the San Jose Police Substation as an example. You have a consultant that comes in who has business ties with the contracting community. And what they – so – there's a change order that comes, okay? And the change order to do a change order on the building should be about $50,000. So the contractor comes back with a $150,000 a change order, and that consultant doesn't really care if he pays this any money. They just sign the thing off, and who's going to be policing that?
Well, Rich, I thank you for that highlighting of the dangers of moving into privatization. What would you say to Rich on those points, Adrian Moore?
Yeah, that's an excellent point because we had some discussion earlier about the government doesn't do a good job of managing contracts in many cases. And I think in those cases, the problem is the management. Why are they hiring consultants that do a lousy job and cost too much? Why aren't they overseeing the contracts well? Why do we believe that if they're not doing those things, that before when they had a bunch of staff to manage, that they were doing a good job of managing that? If the managers are doing a lousy job, they're doing a lousy job whether you're privatizing or not.
Yeah, but he's also suggesting that you can really get soaked by privatization, I think.
Sure you can. If you're a bad customer, you can really get soaked in collective bargaining, too, if you're incompetent at collective bargaining with the workers. So either you're a good manager and you know what you're doing or you're not. And privatization, if anything, just exposes the management problems that are probably already there and inherent within the current services.
All right. Now, I need to mention that the City Council of San Jose just this week agreed to put a measure on the June ballot that would reduce pensions for new hires, and it would make current employees pay more for pensions unless they switch to a cheaper plan. But let's get a response from you, Donald Cohen.
Well, there is a difference between management of when you are in control of your unit, of the workers work for you, and when you are managing contracts. You're now at arm's length. So it's really not the same skill set exactly. I just want to disagree with Adrian on that point. I mean, I think, you know, the when you have something close, you manage it, you can adjust. We've all contracted for things. I've been a consultant in my life. You know, you have a different relationship with the end product. And consultants will come in without the benefit of institutional knowledge, come in. They typically do charge a great deal more per, you know, on an hourly basis, and then they leave. And so, you know, they leave with the institutional knowledge as well. So this is about good management and good government. There's a real difference between contracting and not. You know, I think I wanted to comment on the Colorado story that Robert Smith talked about. I mean, I think, you know, it says a couple things, you know, one of which is there's no free lunch, that we have to pay for the things we value. And so that's why, you know, and what they found is, you know, sort of his conclusion was it really didn't save much money, but people had a certain set of values in Colorado Springs. But, you know, if we want government to provide, if we want public services, then we have to pay for them. So that privatization is sold as a cost savings is what I find bewildering. Because we've heard over and over again just on this call that's, for a great deal, it's not true. But that's consistently how it's described. And the costs of losing control of our public services and public assets tend to have unintended consequences that do cost us money in the end. So, you know, the debate has gone to the wrong place.
Well, it is certainly an ongoing debate on so many nuances of it. And I want to get more callers on here. And Daniel, let's get you on. Welcome.
I'm a union rep. I represent nurses and technicians and cooks and janitors at Sonoma Developmental Center, a state facility that cares for severely developmentally disabled. For 10 years, the custodians here were contracted out to a private contractor. The folks who did the work got $9 or $10 an hour. Most of them were undocumented aliens, didn't speak English, and it took several attacks on the clients to get the state to actually look at that contract. They were getting $9 or $10 an hour. The contractor was charging the state, the taxpayers, almost $30 an hour, pocketing the difference, exploiting the workers. We got it back under the state, and now the workers make $12, $13 an hour, still a poverty wage, but better. But they have medical insurance. They're screened. They get a security background check. They're citizens. They're trained. We're not having people mixing bleach and ammonia and evacuating a ward anymore. The work's better, the working conditions are better, and the taxpayers are saving hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars a year.
Well, let me thank you for that, Daniel. Let me go also back to John Ortiz. I mean, when it comes down to it, I don't know how much you've done, John, in the way of number crunching, but from a taxpayer standpoint or from a citizen standpoint, where do they really save more money?
By privatizing?
Yeah.
Because of the way we work, we never focus on the stuff that works in the media. We always focus on the things that don't. And I can't, off the top of my head, think of a single case where the state saved money by contracting. Today in the newspaper, I write about the state pension fund's computer system that it contracted out, and it now has run past $500 million in cost overruns. And it's still not working right. I don't believe that most of the time the state, anyway, views contracts as a way to save. They view it as a way to bring in expertise or to fill temporary needs, some of the things that were mentioned earlier.
Well, here's a listener who writes on our website, private sector participation in government services like water often accentuates efficiencies and innovations the government simply can't do. What's lacking is honest, transparent regulations to mandate the open kimono of full disclosure that is now available on the Internet. Another listener, Roka, writes, privatization is theft of public assets by cronies of politicians, and these assets are sold for a fraction of their value, and the result is that prices often double for whatever services were offered, while the parasitic cronies who took over give themselves huge salaries. Services rarely improve with privatization and frequently become worse, while costs of government often increase. Just look at the private economy complex, the private military contractors, etc. Another web comment, public service bargaining units are not unions. The members do not risk what legitimate union members, farm workers, miners, factory workers, etc. do when organizing against the power of capital. Frank writes on our web, and you can, by the way, put your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or go to our Facebook page. Frank writes, this bill just seems tone deaf for the current political environment. I support public employees, but with their wages and benefits under attack across the nation, a bill perceived as expanding their rights in other areas just seems to give ammunition to those who are attacking public unions. And a couple more web comments. This is a listener who writes, using expensive public employees for government services will only aggravate our budget situation. This will drive the need for higher taxes and cuts to much-needed welfare programs. And if it is cheaper to use public employees, then there's really no need for the bill. Gil says, Bell, California is a perfect example of how dedicated public employees are to the welfare of the community. I think the recent fiasco in Stockton is another perfect example. Government does good work for some specific areas like administering public policy, but managing business types of endeavors is not their best use. And just a couple of emails here before we go to more of your calls. Here's Mike, who says, interesting the way having support from unions is automatically painted as somehow wrong. Special interest groups do support politicians. Our system permits and encourages it. I think the only reason union support is portrayed as bad is because Republicans do the portraying, and our media, I'm sorry to say, takes its moral compass from the business, chamber, utilities, loud voices. Raising taxes is seen as evil, not just the occasionally normal cost of putting on a state program. And Colin writes, thank you for covering this. I wanted to ask whether anyone has done a broad analysis of where the state has saved costs or paid them in past contracts. While cases are illustrative, I think that it is worth asking about the general rate of pay and the past history. The only related work I am aware of is the study by the Project of Government Oversight, which found that at the federal level, contractors are compensated at roughly 1.83 times as much as federal employees. And even as those same employees are cost about 1.2 times as much as private workers. So let me go, Adrian Moore, back to you. Where do we see examples of real cost savings?
Well, you know, there's many, many examples of cost savings. In fact, there's the vast academic literature. I've got file drawers full of published academic journal studies looking at privatization, and what they find is sometimes it saves money and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes it does because of how it's structured, and sometimes because of what you're doing. As we've had some discussion, a lot of privatization is about getting access to expertise or doing something faster, or it's not really aimed at saving money. But when privatization is aimed at saving money, it very often does. I mean, I'm looking on my shelf here at three books that are full of case studies of privatizations that have saved money.
So, do you have any notable ones in California that you can think of offhand?
Or? Well, the state of California hasn't had a whole lot of luck at doing this. There's a lot more examples at the local level. I mentioned earlier, just to stick with the example I brought up of Richmond, California, when it privatized its water 30 years ago. It did that because it had to build a new plant to treat the water, and it was going to cost them a great deal of money that they didn't have. The private sector was willing to pay for the building of that plant if they could then operate it for a period of time, and they did, and it saved the city of Richmond tens of millions of dollars 30 years ago, which is a whole lot of money in their budget, and they've changed the private company that operates that facility over the years, but they've kept it private because it's continued to save them money compared to what they would have to pay if they brought it back in-house and had to hire all the staff.
All right,
lots of examples.
Let me go back, if I may, to Donald Cohen. I want to get to more callers here, but there's an email, Donald Cohen, I'd like you to respond to. It's from a listener who says, I live and work in San Francisco. Please do not mention my name on the air. We don't do that as a practice. He says, I work for a public entity. My boss has a union, and that protects his position, making it very hard to fire him. I, however, do not have a union. My boss has actively worked to prevent us from unionizing. So unionizing has meant that I get abused while he gets higher wages and protections. I'm not anti-union, but this is the third time that unions have hosed me. How can workers who want decent treatment from both unions and management get that equitable treatment?
I really can't respond to that. I have no idea what the circumstances are, and I'm not here to promote or protect unions. I think, you know, in the end, call another union and try to get a union. I mean, that's
well. Let's go to the bigger question, though, that really goes to the heart of this bill that's put before the assembly.
Let me comment on the bill because I hadn't heard of it before.
Yeah.
I was contacted by your staff last night, and as I listened to the assemblyman this morning, it really does sound. And I look at contracting around the country. It sounds like a contracting protection bill.
Yes, it is.
It sounds like good government to me. It doesn't, you know, I know it's portrayed, and perhaps the title of the bill is public sector protection, you know, whatever it's called specifically. But it sounds like it's a, you know, contracting happens sometimes for the wrong reasons. It happens sometimes because there is poor management in public sector, and it's easier to sign a contract than organize your workers to get a job done. So, you know, I agree with Adrian. Management is everything in this game. You know, and that's what we want is great management of public institutions. So it sounds to me that this bill adds a protection to make sure that we're not contracting because someone's got a relationship. Someone who has authority to contract has a relationship with a private sector vendor. They're not because they're lazy or because of, for whatever reason, they haven't taken the time to figure out if the public sector has the capacity to do the job. Because if that's the case, then it would be a cost saving, and it makes a ton more sense to do it public. So I don't see it as public sector protection. It sounds to me far more like protections against some of the downsides that can come with contracting.
John Ortiz, how do you read that?
I think that it's the assemblyman playing to his base. I really do. I think that this is he is representative to the most state employee intensive district in California, and this is a time when state government is downsizing. And this is something that the unions have wanted very badly for a very long time. And he is meeting a political need, I think.
All right, let me fulfill the need of our callers. We've got a lot of people waiting on the line here.
Political dynamic to this, but that's the sort of the unfortunate part of all of this is that we can't have a discussion about what creates good government. So I'm just listening to the bill without the political screen because I'm not there. And it sounds like things I've looked at across the country, it sounds like certainly components of it, because I don't know the whole bill, are just a good idea for good government.
Well, I think implicitly we are talking about what makes for good government. But let me get Lori on next. Lori, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I have a few comments to make. I am a city employee. I won't mention the city. I need to mention that if water and wastewater, which is what your speakers are talking of, are highly regulated industries, and the regulations are being increased year by year. To work in a facility, it's not just pull someone in off the street. You need to have somebody that's certified. It's a certified professional work job. You have to be certified in drinking water through the Department of Public Health. You have to be certified through the State Water Resources Control Board to be in wastewater. It's not a job that you can just drop a contracting firm in and just plug and play. It takes a long time, many years, and lots of certification. And water is not just a nice thing to have. We need sewage treatment. We need water treatment. Very important.
All right, Lori, I thank you for that call. Appreciate hearing from you. I want to go to another caller, and that's James, who's calling us from Denver, Colorado. James, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. And my comments actually go pretty well in line with what Lori just had, in that there are certain – I feel like we're oversimplifying the discussion a little bit because there are certain things that there are a – there's a competitive, private sector out there for certain things that can more efficiently provide services than the government. And then there are other things like water that there's just not really any public sector firms out there, or at least not enough to be competitive where the public market, or the private market rather, can provide it more efficiently than the government.
And James, you're right near the city we were talking about, Colorado Springs.
In fact, I'm driving right now from Colorado Springs up to Denver. I was just in Colorado Springs, and I enjoyed hearing that leaving the city. And it's a very nice city, so something's working right there. But I think this day and age, when we're working so hard on trying to make the government more efficient, decrease spending, it's important to look at some initiatives out there and understand that the private sector can, in fact, provide some things more efficiently than the government. And to Lori's point, there are some things where the private sector, the competition just doesn't exist out there where the private sector can provide it more efficiently than the government. And we need to have a more honest discussion, in that thread.
All right. I'm glad you called, and I thank you for the call. And I'm going to go back to you, John Ortiz. John Ortiz, again, a reporter for the Sacramento Bee who writes the paper's blog on state workers. Is this bill likely to go through?
I think a good chunk of it could get to the governor's desk, sure.
And what will it mean politically? I mean, you kind of indicated before that it puts Governor Brown in a pickle, but can we move from that pickle to what it might? I mean, we're talking about a sour pickle here.
Well, he is notoriously unpredictable when it comes to these things. I could see perhaps if this bill gets to his desk without some of the reducing the statute of limitations, for example, by which management can discipline employees, some things like that that are a little more controversial, he might sign it.
Well, we
I'm
will continue to watch and wait and see how this all unfolds. And I think this is a rather earnest and certainly enlightening conversation on privatization. I thank Assemblyman Roger Dickinson, who joined us earlier. And I thank Joe Ortiz, again, reporter for the Sacramento Bee. My thanks also to Donald Cohen, chair of In the Public Interest, and Adrian Moore, vice president of policy with the Reason Foundation. And we also spoke with Robert Smith of NPR's Planet Money. We thank you for being with us. We are here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always let us know what you think about Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. And you can continue this discussion on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our interns are Keith Manconi, Ernesto Morales, Kyle Palmer, Dana Verinsky, and Catalina Villegas. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.